I'm Sheila Kast, and this is Midday. The trial of the first Baltimore police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray started a few hours ago, while in Chicago, another police-involved death is triggering protests, following release of a dashcam video showing a white police officer last year firing 16 bullets into an African-American teenager. That officer has been charged with first-degree murder. Is there a connection between the deaths of black men in police custody and the surge in homicides in Baltimore, Chicago, Milwaukee, and some other big cities? With police-involved shootings under scrutiny, how are cops reacting? Some blame the crime spike on less proactive policing. Are cops pulling back? Are they worried about being filmed doing their jobs? The Ferguson Effect on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Kast. I'm so glad you're with us. The process of choosing a jury has started in the first trial of one of the six Baltimore police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Last April, Officer William Porter was called as a backup during the police transport of Gray. He helped the driver check on Gray and reportedly asked Gray if he required medical attention. Trying Officer Porter first is thought to be part of the prosecution's strategy. They have called Porter, quote, a necessary and material witness, end quote, in the case against the other officers. In this hour, we'll be talking about perception, how police believe they are perceived, what effects that has on their performance, and how the public views police. Later in the hour, we'll speak with a Baltimore police officer and a former officer, now a lawyer in Washington, as well as with an academic. But we're going to start with a recent survey out of the University of Baltimore Schaefer Center for Public Policy. It surveyed more than 800 people from across the state. The survey asked about observations of police activity, police treatment of minorities, unfair treatment by police, use of force, and police discipline. The takeaway? While a large majority of Marylanders believe that police are doing a good job fighting crime in their neighborhoods, many also report that officers do not treat blacks and minorities the same way as whites. And with us to discuss the survey is Ann Cotton, director of the Schaefer Center for Public Policy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheila. Thanks for having me here today.
So tell us about the survey. How was the data collected? How were people surveyed?
The Schaefer Center conducted a telephone poll from September 1st to October 19th of this year. We surveyed people on landline telephone, random digit dial. And our job, we were looking at people's perceptions on a number of public policy issues. And this year we added policing as one of the issues that we were looking at.
So you talked to people both on landlines and you also had an adjustment for people who use cell phones?
Yes, right? We did.
A lot of places you contrast the findings that you found in Baltimore City with the Baltimore region and with the state. What goes into the Baltimore region?
So the Baltimore region are the counties surrounding the Baltimore City, so Baltimore County, Howard County, Harford, Carroll, Anne Arundel. And then we examine Baltimore City separately and then the rest of the state.
Okay. How would you summarize the most important findings?
I think the most important findings are that people really have different experiences with police. People in Baltimore City and African Americans have very different experiences than whites and people in the rest of the state. They have more negative opinions of police. And in addition to that, they've been more likely to feel they've been treated unfairly by police.
Let's break that down into some of the many questions that you ask. On the issue of satisfaction with police performance, overall, most people reported police did a very good job or somewhat good job fighting crime. With that question, just looking at Baltimore City residents, how do they compare to people in the metro region and the rest of the state?
So across Maryland, we had 88% of the respondents thinking that police do a very good job or somewhat good job fighting crime. This number drops to 76% in Baltimore City and increases to 93% in the rest of the state. Satisfaction with fighting crime among African Americans is 81%, although only 33% of African Americans say that the police do a very good job of fighting crime.
I missed that percentage. There's a lot of numbers here. Let's sort of
33%.
A third.
There's 81% African Americans think that police do a very good job, do a good job fighting crime, but only one third of them think that they do a very good job. So 33% of African Americans think that police do a very good job in fighting crime. And when you contrast that to whites, 58% of whites think that police do a very good job fighting crime. So while they, while both groups are supportive of police and think that police do a good job of fighting crime, the intensity of that support differs by the two groups.
You also asked people what they observed police doing. How did you determine the most common police behaviors and what you should ask about?
So we asked residents about, we asked our respondents about what they saw police doing when they were interacting with them. And we had a number of different things that we asked about, but the two most important are police driving through the neighborhood and police making arrests. So 67% of African Americans see the police driving through their neighborhood daily or at least once a week, compared to 55% of whites.
And this is, in this breakdown, you're looking at African American responses throughout the state.
Throughout the state, yes.
And tell me again, two-thirds of them, 67%, see police driving in their neighborhoods every day?
Yes, every day or once a week or every day. So we combine those two for seeing them frequently.
Okay.
And then that compares to 55% of whites. So close, but African Americans see police more in their neighborhood more frequently. And when it comes to making arrests, 28% of African Americans see the police making arrests in their neighborhood at least once a week or every day. And this compares to 7% of whites. And this is across the state.
28% of African Americans see lots of arrests, only 7% of whites. So it's four times, if you're African American in Maryland, you're four times as likely to see police arresting people.
Yes, that's correct.
Is there anything you asked that would get at the question of whether your respondents think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
No, we didn't. This is one of many topics that we asked about in our survey, and one of our upcoming research initiatives will be examining this in more depth and on a more regular basis.
I want to get back to the question of how Marylanders and people in Baltimore City and in the Baltimore region, how they perceive police treating minorities compared to other people. Tell me what you asked about that.
So we asked whether or not people thought that minorities were treated differently than whites, so African American or other minorities. And we also asked if people were treated unfairly. So with treatment of minorities, half of Marylanders believe that police do not treat blacks and other minorities the same as whites, while 30% in both groups are treated the same. And interestingly, statewide, 20% of the people didn't have an opinion about this issue. But this perception changes dramatically when you look at Baltimore City and the experience of African Americans. So in Baltimore City, 3 out of 4 Baltimore City residents think that minorities are treated differently than whites, and 3 out of 4 African Americans across the state feel the same way.
Okay. So there's a sharp difference in perception of how police treat minorities, and you see that in the city and you see that across the state.
Yes.
And there was another sub question of that I was trying to get to, and I'm not finding it right now in my notes.
There's another one about actual experience with unfair treatment by police.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the one you're thinking about. So 9% of Marylanders indicate that they've been unfairly treated by police.
Nine
in the past 12 months, and 15% say that a family member has been treated unfairly by police in the past 12 months. This number goes up dramatically for African Americans and for Baltimore City residents. So Baltimore City residents, 18%, or almost three times as many, say that they've been treated unfairly by police in the past 12 months, and 17% of African Americans, compared to 9% of Marylanders in general, say that they've been treated unfairly in the past 12 months. So that's very significant. And there was a recent CNN Kaiser Family Foundation poll that found that 19% of blacks and 3% of whites across the country had reported being treated unfairly by police in the past month. So we're looking at a longer time period, but the proportions are very similar.
You also asked people, do police use more physical force than necessary when dealing with racial and ethnic minorities? And then you ask a similar question, but instead of asking dealing with racial and ethnic minorities, you asked dealing with community members. Tell me about that set of questions and what it showed.
So I don't have that specific number in front of me, but I can tell you the gist of what the question is. When we asked people about whether or not police treated community members unfairly, people were less likely than when we asked them if they treated minorities unfairly. So people have a much higher perception of minorities being treated unfairly than community members. So community members, people can often perceive as people like me, as opposed to people when we're specifically saying minorities. So they think that minorities are treated unfairly more frequently. So when we changed the question slightly from community members to minorities, the perception of unfair treatment increases significantly.
So I'm trying to understand this. Are you saying that people who are respondents who themselves are not minorities are more likely to say minorities aren't treated fairly than they are to say people in my community aren't?
Not exactly. So, and what I'm saying is both groups are more likely to say that minorities are treated unfairly when, instead of using the word community, people in the community. So as when we're more specific, people think that the untreatment is more prevalent.
Well, I guess I also wonder whether that is an indication that people think in general, somewhere out there, minorities are probably not being treated fairly by police, but in my community, it's okay.
I'm not sure exactly saying in my community it's okay. What they're saying is that people that are community members are a very general term.
Mm-hmm.
And minorities and African Americans are very specific terms. So
right. They
can ascribe that question to a very specific group of people. So I think when we get more specific and ask about a particular group of people, they think that the police are more likely to treat them unfairly.
You also asked some questions that have a lot of resonance right now as the trials are starting, the first trial of a police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray. Jury selection started this morning. Almost 3 out of 5, 60% of Baltimore City residents told you that police officers usually get off with no punishment when they do something wrong. That was the city response.
That was the city response, and it is very high when compared to the surrounding counties. So if we look in the Baltimore metropolitan area, but excluding Baltimore City, 35% of the respondents feel that way, so almost half as many. So people in the city are twice as likely to think that police officers get off without much punishment. And in addition to that, when we look at Baltimoreans and residents, 35% of Baltimoreans feel that their family members have been mistreated compared to 11% of people in the surrounding county. So the perception that police get off more frequent is higher in the city, so almost twice as high, and people are almost three times as likely to have negative experiences with the police in the city.
So what are your thoughts about that as we look at jury selection in all these trials coming up? What kind of insights do you think this poll gives us about
that's a very interesting question, because the jury selection process obviously is designed to seat an impartial jury. But given the experiences that people have in the city and African Americans have with police and how different they are, I think that it's a challenge to select an impartial jury. And in the end, all the jurors are going to really need to set aside their personal experience and listen to the facts. And I think it's a very challenging situation to try and seat a jury, given all the media attention and the actual differences in experience that people have.
Let me ask you one other thing before I let you go, and it may not be something that that your survey leads to, but given all these questions and all these responses in different parts of the state, do you come away with any ideas about how the police can change the perception of them?
So there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One is that we did a survey a number of years ago looking at where people get information and how they collect data when they're forming an opinion about city services. And most people get their information from the media. So it's really important for the police to work with the media to communicate any strategies that they are following for improving relations with the community. Of course, real change is most important. The police really do have to change. They have to be more transparent, and they have to enhance the dialogue between the police and the community. And it's going to be really important to do regular surveying or polling to see what impact these changes are having on the community. And one of the things I would recommend is actually talking to people about their experiences with the police very specifically, instead of the kind of general opinion polling that we were doing, but actually looking very directly with the experience people are having day to day with the police. And then keeping in mind that a public opinion lags an actual change in attitude and behavior. So as the police may change, it's going to take a while for the community opinion to change.
So if we don't see a change in the kind of polling that you do, that doesn't necessarily mean things are not being worked on and not changing.
Right. I would recommend making sure we look at real objective data and then add to that the public opinion polling.
Anne, I really appreciate you walking us through this.
Thank you very much.
Anne Cotton, she is director of the Schaefer Center for Public Policy at the University of Baltimore. We've been talking about a poll that they completed this fall about attitudes toward police. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, the Ferguson effect. It's been hotly debated in the news, even among top officials in the Obama administration. We're going to hear from a scholar and from two people with experience in the Baltimore police force, a current officer and a former officer who is now a lawyer. We are interested in what you think about how police. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. As you've been hearing, today begins jury selection in the first trial of one of the six Baltimore police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. In August 2014, Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American teenager, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, by Darren Wilson, a white police officer there. The incident sparked intense protests in the city. You may recall all those protests that went on and on, and the Missouri National Guard was called in by the governor. A St. Louis County grand jury decided not to indict Officer Wilson in connection with Brown's death. The incident, as well as other highly publicized police-involved deaths, including those of Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Laquan McDonald, have given rise to a theory that negative publicity is driving a pullback by police. The New York Times reported in August that Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Milwaukee, St. Louis all have seen increases of 40% or more in their homicide rates. Baltimore surpassed 300 murders earlier this month. According to Baltimore police spokesman T.J. Smith, the city's homicide clearance rate, making an arrest or identifying a suspect, is about 32%. That's about half the national clearance rate of 64% as reported by the FBI based on 2013 data. So that's not completely up-to-date data. The Baltimore Sun looked at the arrests rate in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray protests. While police made an average of 2,630 arrests a month between January and April of 2015, arrests fell to 1,557 in May. Since then, arrests have gone back up again, 2,095 in June, almost 2,500 in July, 2,300 in August. To probe into this a bit, we are joined now by Scott Wolf from the University of South Carolina's Criminology and Criminal Justice Department. Scott Wolf is co-author of a study titled The Alleged Ferguson Effect and Police Willingness to engage in Community Partnership. Scott Wolf, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you could join us. For this study, you sampled sheriff's deputies in a southeastern metropolitan county. You did not identify where it is. How would you describe the sheriff's department that you looked at? How many deputies did you survey?
Sure. Yeah, we surveyed just over 550 deputies, about 567 to be exact. The sheriff's department in this particular area is very unique because it's a large jurisdiction both in population and geographically. And so what's nice about the agency, especially from a research standpoint with dealing with this issue, is that it spans both large urban areas and very rural areas. And so you get a sheriff's department that experiences things that are similar to a local-level city police department and more common things that are normally associated with a sheriff's agency.
And so what were you trying to establish in this study? What were the questions you were trying to answer, and what did you find?
Sure. So this Ferguson effect debate was really gaining steam towards the beginning of this year, especially quickly following the death of Freddie Gray. And there was a lot of discussion coming out in the media, talked about by both academics, media folks, and even law enforcement officers, that there's going to be this increase in violent crime in particular because of this so-called alleged Ferguson effect. We kind of looked at that as from a criminological standpoint and said that might be a stretch. Crime's really complex. It might be a little difficult to observe an increase in violent crime from whatever this Ferguson effect may be, but there may be something there. There may be more of a proximate effect on officers, on deputies, when they engage with the public. They're seeing this negative publicity. It's constant. And it may impact their motivation to be officers on the street. It may make it less fun to be a cop. And that, in turn, that kind of Ferguson effect may have an important influence on other aspects of what we look at as de-policing, not so much an increase in violent crime, but maybe just a pullback of willingness to engage in community partnership.
So how did you try to tease that out?
So what we did is we surveyed the deputies and asked them very broad questions, no specific reference to any Ferguson effect or particular events. The survey was administered in February this year, so it was about 6 months after the Michael Brown death in Ferguson, Missouri. And we asked them about their motivation as a result of the negative publicity over the past 6 months, whether it's been less enjoyable to be in law enforcement over the past 6 months. And then we ask other survey questions about their general overall attitudes regarding their willingness or utility in working with the community to solve problems.
And what were your basic conclusions?
So what we found is there's somewhat of what you could call a Ferguson effect. A sizable, non-trivial portion of these deputies indicated that they've become less motivated since the events in Ferguson. It's been more difficult to be a cop. And that was even correlated with a lack of willingness to partner with the community, to work with the community. Importantly, however, what really was driving that effect, lack of willingness to engage in community partnership, was how fairly they felt they were treated by their supervisors, how much dignity and respect their supervisors give them. If there's more dignity, respect, organizational justice, as we term it, they were more likely to engage in community partnerships. If they were more confident in their own authority, they were more likely. And so what happened is, once you account for those more important factors, this Ferguson effect really drops out and becomes insignificant.
So it's possible that there is a Ferguson effect. It's something that police management can compensate for.
Indeed, yeah. And so, it's the Ferguson effect itself is difficult to wrap our heads around what is this. It really depends on what you're talking about. And so in our context, you could say lack of motivation is the so-called Ferguson effect. The important question becomes, does it translate into anything, and maybe even more importantly, can management do something about it? Indeed, they probably can. They can engage in organizational justice, treating their employees fairly, objectively, making sure that decisions are handled in a transparent fashion with their employees, right? And that essentially gives them a sense that their agency is there for them, right? They have their back. And so there's less willingness or less result of this so-called Ferguson effect impacting their motivation, if that can be established.
That is Scott Wolf from the University of South Carolina's Criminology and Criminal Justice Department here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. We're talking about a study he co-authored titled The Alleged Ferguson Effect and Police Willingness to Engage in Community Partnership. I want to pull in now. I've got two people with a lot of insights about this with me in the studio. Kenneth Butler is a 30-year police veteran, a lieutenant with the Baltimore Police Department. He is president of the Vanguard Justice Society, a union within the Baltimore Police Department that, is union the right way to describe it? It's an association of black police officers, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Fights for the rights of minority and female officers.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also here is Adam Braskich, an attorney with Miller and Chevalier, a Washington, D.C. law firm. He served as a Baltimore police officer from 2007 to 2011. He wrote an op-ed that ran in the Baltimore Sun last May titled Stop Demanding the Impossible of Police. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Lieutenant Butler, before I ask you about the Ferguson effect, let me just ask, going into the Freddie Gray trials, how has the department been preparing?
Well, I mean, that's like today. Of course, everyone, it's business as usual. However, there have been certain entities within the department that have been on more of a higher alert than the patrol has been. But it's business as usual.
Okay. About the Ferguson effect, you were quoted in a Baltimore Sun article in May saying, quote, in 29 years, I've gone through some bad times, but I've never seen it this bad. I'm hearing it from guys who were go-getters, who would go out there and get the guns and the bad guys and drugs. They're hands off now. Is that still, close quote, is that still the way you look at it?
No, well, things have changed. And I would have to agree with Mr. Wolf when he said, when your supervisors back you, then rank-and-file officers are more, they will go out and perform like they usually did. And I used to say to former Commissioner Bax, I said, hey, listen, if there's a situation where an officer has to use force, and it may look bad, but however, if the officer operated well within departmental policy and training guidelines, you as the commander in chief need to come out and say, hey, listen, it may have looked bad, but the officer operated well within departmental guidelines. And let me say this, there is no pretty way to use force, no matter what. And I always use an example of a football game. Yeah, the receiver goes across the middle and he gets hit and he gets hit hard and the ball is separated. Well, it may not have looked good, but it was a legal hit within the NFL. It was a legal hit. The same with us. You may have maced someone. You may have tased someone. It may not look good, but did the officer operate well within departmental guidelines and trainings?
Adam Braskich, you were a Baltimore police officer. You went to Harvard Law. In your op-ed in May, you wrote about community police relations and how some tactics taken by police officers hurt those relationships. How do you look at the situation now?
Well, I think that the tactics have gotten better over the years if you compare the current era to, say, I have to apologize to the O'Malley presidential administration, but that era of...
It's a campaign at this point. It's not a presidential administration.
But they, they had a sort of zero-tolerance policy that I think really undermined the police-community relationship,
mm-hmm.
and
it
things
did.
Have gotten a lot
yes,
better
it did.
Since then. And still, however, there's an extent to which the police department uses enforcement as the primary means of quelling violence. And enforcement is everything from car stops to accosting people walking down the street, stop and frisk, arrests. And, I think that these tactics do, to a certain extent, quell violent crime. But at the same time, it can make the residents of the neighborhoods where these tactics are used feel oppressed and feel that they're being treated unfairly by the police.
Let me just remind our listeners, they can be part of this conversation, but they can call us at 410-662-8780. Or if it's a long distance call, use our toll free number 866-661-8780. 9309 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Scott Wolf, you're still with us in South Carolina, right?
Yep, I'm here.
When you hear these Baltimore officers, Adam Braskich, a former officer, and Lieutenant Butler, who is still on the force, when you hear them talk about these tactics and also the support that a police officer should be able to expect, this seems like it fits right into your research, correct?
It certainly does, yeah. It's encouraging, and we hear that from a lot of officers and deputies throughout the country. They realize the importance of treating one's employees fairly. It's a struggle, though, even as a non-cop, I can imagine it's a struggle because it's a paramilitary structure. There has to be a command. There's a hierarchy. But ensuring that fairness goes such a long way, and it translates into what we call procedural justice on the streets. You know, there's effective strategies that cops can do to impact crime. What's really important, as we talked about, is those aggressive strategies can alienate. But if we translate that into fair treatment of citizens on the street, that can go a long way in reducing crime.
Let's hear from Juan, who is calling us from Baltimore. Juan, welcome to Midday. Juan? We seem to have lost Juan. So let me ask you, Lieutenant Butler, you were agreeing vociferously about the problems of broken windows enforcing or lots of arrests. It seems to me it's been a while since that was.
But it still has an effect. It still has a negative effect. And when that was going on, I was a shift commander in the Southern District at that time. And it was just numbers, 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 numbers. And I didn't agree with that. But as a soldier, I have to do what I'm told to do. Mm-hmm. But as Adam said, that really alienated a lot of people in the community where you were just making arrest. Because I think at that time, and I know I'm probably going to get it wrong, but I think we arrested over 100,000 people.
I have read that number, that in a city of 600,000, there were 100,000 arrests in one of those years.
Right. And I know, and from speaking with citizens, that really alienated us from the community. And, you know, I know what Adam said as far as the O'Malley administration, but that really separated the police department and the community.
So how do you see, you're saying it separated then, and that feeling continues today, even though the tactic is no longer there.
Yeah, the feeling continues today. However, it's gotten a lot better because when I speak with citizens and they realize, okay, we're not doing that anymore. And a lot of the citizens are actually happy that we're not doing that. And you'd be surprised how many police are happy that we're not doing that any longer. And it may take some time, but I think where we're going now, we're starting to bridge that gap. It won't happen overnight, but it is starting to happen.
We're going to talk more about that after we take a break. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Lieutenant Kenneth Butler, a 30-year police veteran in the Baltimore Police Department, president of the Vanguard Justice Society, with Adam Braskich, an attorney at Miller & Chevalier, a Washington, D.C. law firm, who was a Baltimore police officer from 2007 and 2011, and with Scott Wolf, a researcher at the University of South Carolina, co-author of a study about the alleged Ferguson effect. And we hope that you will be with us in this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to be back in just a bit. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Ferguson effect, the theory that negative press is causing police to pull back. Joining us by phone is Scott Wolf, assistant professor in the criminology department at the University of South Carolina, co-author of a study titled The Alleged Ferguson Effect and Police Willingness to Engage in Community Partnership. And here with me in the studio is Lieutenant Kenneth Butler, a 30-year police veteran of the Baltimore Police Department, president of the Vanguard Justice Society, an association within the Baltimore Police Department that fights for the rights of minority and female officers, former shift commander in the Southern District, the Police Department Southern District. And Adam Braskich is an attorney at Miller & Chevalier, a Washington, D.C. law firm, served as a Baltimore police officer from 2007 to 2011. And we just had a small reunion here in the studio because Lieutenant Butler recognized Adam Braskich as somebody who was for a while under his command in the Baltimore Police Department. Since we're talking about the Baltimore Police Department, I want at this point to play a clip when former Commissioner Anthony Batts, who was fired by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake in July, in September he spoke to students at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, and he connected the increase in crime to police officers feeling that their superiors did not have their backs. Here's part of what he said.
So I think part of the crime rate that's happening in Baltimore is that the police officers at some point took a knee. And they're just doing that like other officers. And I started asking officers, why is that occurring? And what the officers are sharing with me is that they believe no one is standing up for me. The police officers in Baltimore that will tell you is that they felt that I wasn't standing up for them at the end, at the conclusion either. And they feel, and I asked them, what is it that you want out of a police chief? What is it that you're looking for? And to hear them say it is that anything that they do, they want that police chief to stand up and say, my guys were right. Well, you can't do that. And you have to, what's going to be very interesting for police chiefs in the future right now is going to be an interesting balance. Now, what happened to me is the crime rate went up and I lost my job. Is this going to be a tactic where police officers don't feel that they're supported, so they allow the crime rate to go up and the reformers lose their jobs?
After former Commissioner Batts made those comments, both Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis said they disagreed with him about sort of the whole analysis. But let me ask you, Lieutenant Butler, what went through your mind when you heard Anthony Batts' assessment of what was going on in the Baltimore Police Department?
Well, let me say this. No one took a knee, okay? Officers came to work every day. No one called in medical on my shift. There was no blue flu. And when former Commissioner Batts said, as far as a police chief, you can't say my guys did something right. No, you can if they did something right, no matter how it may look to the public. That's a leader. However, if they did something wrong, then as a leader, you say they need to be held accountable. And I have always said that. If you maliciously do something wrong as a police officer, knowingly and maliciously do something wrong, you need to be held accountable. But for him to say we took a knee, oh, absolutely not.
Well, let me probe a little bit. And Scott Wolf, if you want to jump in here, I'd be interested in your comments. Took a knee is not a is not a very precise term.
And no, I know what he meant.
Okay.
Okay.
Tell us what you think he meant.
He tried to say that we laid down. These officers didn't lay down. He was not a good leader. And that was the bottom line. That's why he lost his job. He was not a good leader. No one took a knee.
Because some people in other cities, I'm not saying this is true among in the Baltimore Police Department, but some people have said officers they're showing up for work and they're reporting for their shifts. They're just kind of less likely to get out of the car and less likely to engage the community in some of these cities. That's not what you're seeing, I'm assuming.
No, officers were still making great handgun arrests during this time.
Scott Wolf, what are your thoughts when you hear Anthony Batts say that?
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback off of what Mr. Butler was saying, It seems, I say this from a citizen standpoint and a researcher standpoint, it appears odd as an executive at a law enforcement agency to take a podium in a press conference and indicate that your officers are standing down, are depolicing, taking a knee, whatever you want to call it, because that in essence it seems like you're admitting as an executive that you don't have their back. Taking the stand, like what Mr. Boatwell was saying, you know, taking a podium and talking about the public that we welcome you to videotape us, tape us. You're going to see us doing a good job. If we don't do a good job, we will hold our officers accountable because that's what we want. That's the trust. And to say that there's a depolicing effect or this Ferguson effect that's causing your cops to not do their job seems particularly dangerous.
Let's hear from some of our callers. Deborah in Baltimore has a question. Deborah, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I find this panel to be really engaging. I'm a Baltimore City resident. I can't speak for some of the other cities, but I can definitely speak for D.C. and Baltimore in this. I've seen a lot of cases of people just being utterly disrespectful all the time to the police. And I see that as really being a problem because, I mean, when I was a child, you had a healthy respect for the police, and that kind of kept you from doing some of the things that you probably shouldn't do. But now it seems that it's almost impossible for them to do simple things because people are so volatile and so ready to jump in their face and so really to be aggressive and totally disrespect any part of what I thought police were. And I'm worried that that's such a huge effect on the communities that, I mean, I don't know how to fix that. How do we get that type of thing under control? I mean, there's just no respect for the police at all. And I've seen it time and time and time again.
Okay, let's see what some of the people here think about that. I appreciate your question, Deborah. Adam, what crosses your mind when you hear Deborah say lack of respect?
Well, I think police officers are professionals, and they can handle being disrespected. That shouldn't affect how they do their jobs. But I do think the level of scrutiny has gotten so great, especially in certain parts of Baltimore and in the Western District, that officers do feel a little bit hesitant about engaging in the sort of proactive policing that they might normally do, accosting people on the street, making stops. And it's not to say that they are laying down and not willing to do their jobs. To bring this back to Professor Wolf's report, I think what police officers are worried about is not having their face on YouTube or CNN, but procedural justice. And to the extent that police officers feel that they might be disciplined unfairly or even criminally prosecuted for what they see as a reasonable mistake made in a very tense situation, I think that can have a chilling effect on how police officers do their jobs. And I think that was the sentiment of many Baltimore police officers after the filing of charges in the Freddie Gray case.
Lieutenant Butler, let me get your reaction to that. The distinction between, okay, it's not the disrespect that Deborah talks about. It's not the cell phone videos. It's the fear of being held legally accountable for what you thought was a fair decision.
Yes, and I would have to agree with Adam. You have some officers who will say, look, if I made a mistake, then I'll own up to my mistake. But don't let me be a sacrificial lamb due to political and public pressure. That's what officers are afraid of. We all make mistakes. I mean, I have 30 years old. I still make mistakes. However, don't use that mistake, put it on YouTube, and then leave me out there to be a sacrificial lamb. And if I could address Deborah when she said,
please,
as far as the lack of respect, what I'll say is, when I spoke with Congressman Elijah Cummings, and we both agreed, the criminal element now, they just feel empowered. They feel as though they can do whatever they want, because now all I have to do is make a complaint to Internal Affairs, post something on YouTube, scream long enough and loud enough, and then I'll have the focus on the officer. So I think it's the criminal element that feels empowered. And I understand what she's saying about lack of respect. The majority of people in Baltimore City, they're law-abiding citizens. They respect the police. But it's just that small percentage that disrespect the police, and it's just magnified by the media. But the majority of people, they respect the police.
Let's ask Owen. Owen, we're getting short on time, but if you can make your comment brief. Welcome to the show.
I appreciate the conversation about tactics and ending zero tolerance and broken windows policing, but I think that unless we shift the balance of power between police officers and the communities they police and allow those communities to hold officers accountable in the instances when they do things wrong, then the status quo will continue. And the reason why we don't see cases of police misconduct or brutality in middle-class white communities is because those communities are socially empowered to hold officers accountable when they do that. And so I think that unless the accountability is there, and I'm not saying police officers are committing crimes against the people they're supposed to be protecting every day, but when they do, there's a blue wall of silence, and those officers aren't held accountable. And so I think the question becomes, how do you change the power differential between poor urban communities and the communities they police?
Thanks, Owen, for the question. Adam, you're a lawyer. How do you change the power equation?
Well, I empathize with the caller's sentiment, and I think that there's an argument to be made for perhaps more impartial investigations of police uses of force and allegations of police misconduct. I don't think that police internal investigators generally engage in overt cover-ups, but there can be a sort of subconscious bias that sort of shifts the perception that the investigator has of the case, and they may be tilted in favor of the officer. So it may make the community feel that there's more transparency and more fairness if you had some sort of independent investigative body. These sorts of things exist in other countries like Canada, the UK, Norway. And I think officers would welcome this, so long as the people doing the investigations understand the difference between malicious criminal acts, which officers do sometimes commit and should be held accountable for, and reasonable mistakes, which are made in very tense, split-second decisions.
Scott Wolf, what did your survey tell you about police attitudes toward police accountability measures?
Sure. So the thing that I would emphasize, everybody's talking about is, so this lack of trust that's in some communities in the United States is largely rooted in a long history of racial tension, and for officers to realize that is really important. Kids are raised in some families to have a mistrust for the police. What they can importantly do, though, when they're engaging in broken windows, target enforcement, things that we know work, I hope that does not decline. We know that works. But when they're engaging in community members, when they're doing those enforcement strategies, they have an opportunity for teachable moments. Teach those people that they're interacting with, here's the reason we're here. Tell me your side of the story. Offer them a voice. Show them that you're being fair, why you're here. That will reestablish, over time, baby steps, that trust between the community and the police. Important thing from our study shows is that starts with how fairly administrators treat their own officers and how much confidence they instill in their own officers' authority.
We're down to just a minute. Let me give the last word to you, Lieutenant Butler.
Well, I would have to piggyback on what Adam said. I think, and I'll use an example, if you have someone who lives in a very affluent neighborhood like Sandtown, Winchester versus Guilford, if they see they'll be treated the same if they make a complaint against an officer, then I think that goes a long way.
We are flat out of time, and I'm really grateful to all of you for being part of this conversation. Lieutenant Kenneth Butler, president of the Vanguard Justice Society in the Baltimore Police Department, Adam Braskich, an attorney, former Baltimore City police officer, and Scott Wolf, assistant professor of criminal justice at the University of South Carolina. Thanks to you all, and thanks to our listeners. Tune in tomorrow. We'll talk to the heads of two Maryland-based nonprofits that help young people get ready. Whoops, no, we've done that. This is going to be about reading tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned for Here and Now. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us today.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Droneberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.